All right, it's about that time, 8 o'clock. Good morning, everybody. Happy September 24th. We're getting close to fall now, believe it or not. What a blur, right? So I want to welcome everybody. This is our Santa Clarita chapter for the Aerospace and Defense Forum. I'm Rob Gleason. I'm the chapter chair. And today we're going to do a slightly different chapter session. We're going to have a panel session today to talk about how COVID's impacting our local aerospace and defense businesses. But before we get into that, I want to tell you a little bit about us. We're located up in Santa Clarita, so we are in L.A. County. For those of you that are online and not sure where Santa Clarita is, we're about 30 miles north of L.A. And Holly and her group created a nice graphic there to show where we are located geographically, just north of the craziness just south of us. But we're a growing community, and this is our 10th chapter session for the Santa Clarita Valley, so we're excited about that. We started in September of 2019 last year. I know that seems miles ago, but and we've been going strong. This year, with COVID, we've been doing Zoom calls, and so we'll continue that tradition today. This is our fifth session on Zoom this year, so we're starting to become somewhat experts in Zoom. As a nonprofit, we rely on our sponsorship, and I want to thank both Wells Fargo and the Santa Clarita Economic Development Corporation with Holly, who's going to be co-paneling our session today, or co-hosting. And so I want to thank both of them for their sponsorship and keeping us going. We'd also like to welcome today Gary Singer, who's with Singer Associates. So thanks, Gary, for coming in late to help out. And I'll turn it over to you, Gary, to talk a little bit about your organization.
Robert, thank you. Would you please get the slide? There we go.
Yeah.
It helps me to remember who I am here this morning. It's really a pleasure to be here. I'm a headhunter. I do retained executive search on behalf of companies. They're out there looking for people to add to their senior management and executive team. And I've been in business since 1999, so we're really pleased to be a sponsor for this particular program. I have some people very, very important to me on this call and presenting today, so it's a special pleasure to be that. Next slide, please. Here's how you can find me. Call me anytime. Speaking of any time, I was on the phone last night late. We have a client who is located here. Their corporate office is in Israel, so we're plus 10 on the hours with them, I think. And they have a candidate who they want to hire to head up their space R&D efforts. They want to be in the 50 to 100 million range. This gentleman's in Houston. He has a variety of patents. I was on the phone with him late last night, so we're trying to sort out what this offer would look like for them to join this this client of ours. Next slide. We represent companies, not the individual job seekers. I've had a 10-year relationship with IRC Global Executive Search Partners. They're the largest geographic search alliance in the world. So 45 countries and 90 cities. Other business owners like me are a part of this fantastic alliance. Next. Now, here are four examples of recent searches that we've done. I was trying to represent the diversity of the functions and the levels and the size of businesses. You know, these are significant positions that we've been able to assist our clients to fill. Next, please. There we go. If you look at these search numbers by the numbers, we believe in big numbers. We believe in big data. And so in this particular instance, you can see that from June through September, contracts signed to start the search. This general manager was the person found. Client only had to interview three candidates. And one offer was accepted. This particular gentleman is now our client. He is now the client that we're serving as it relates to this kind of a dream job that I was talking about in terms of being a director of space R&D. Next slide. I was really surprised when we got into this China virus, and I saw it from the distance with my IRC colleagues. My friends in China, my friends in Italy, my friends in the UK were really hit the hardest. But I was really surprised we had no searches canceled. I'm seeing a trend now that we have certain companies that are taking advantage of this opportunity. Before, we would have our final candidates with 4, 5, or 6 offers. So it was incredibly competitive to have our client win in terms of being the company that the candidate would choose. Not any longer. Very few multiple offers for our candidates. We have succession planning happening. We're busier than ever. We have one new client that we've just started. This client is about $1 billion U.S. In the midst of under a European publicly held company, which is about 12 billion euro. This company laid off about 2,000 people of its 12,000 here in the U.S. It has for us directors and VP levels that they're recruiting for, about 10 of them, because they don't have those skills inside their house. So succession planning has been a big deal. We have another client with 4 searches where, in fact, they're looking for those executives and those managers that are going to be running their operation, and they're about $1.5 billion privately held engineering manufacturing company in the next 10 to 15 to 20 years. Virtual interviewing and virtual hiring, they are happening, and they're happening well. Imagine where's my cell phone? If I had this walking through a plant, you might want to turn it on. It would probably be helpful. But if you're walking through a plant or through a distribution facility with your candidate at his or her home, you know, that's in fact how these interviews are happening. Next slide, please. I had one client so far that insisted, pardon me, on an in-person meeting. This was a UK client that had a candidate that we had found in Florida, insisted on this person coming here to be in person at their manufacturing facility. All the rest have been done virtually. You can see some of the mediums here that are used, just like we are today. I mean, normally this would be in person, and we would be having this meeting. But by Zoom, which seems to be second nature right now, is how we're doing that. Next slide, please. My biggest competition is I have a neighbor, I have a friend, I have somebody I've met, I think he or she might be good for my job. Now, is that really fair to your business that you are finding someone that probably doesn't meet all the musts? As you check the boxes with what you ought to have, because as you decide what it is that your company needs in this job in terms of short-term results in the first 3 to 6 months and 3 to 5 years, my advice, best out of all this, would be please don't settle. Don't settle for the candidate that you're going to put into a job that's probably going to impact, you know, a few $100,000 worth of costs, a few $1 million worth of revenue. Don't settle. Next slide, please. I'm Gary Sanger. I'm a proud founder and operator of Sanger Associates, or Retained Executive Search. We've been around since 99. There are 7 of us. That's all we do. I'm a proud member of the Economic Development Corporation. I had a 25-year stint as a board member of the local Santa Cruz Valley Boys and Girls Club. It's really a pleasure to be here this morning. Robert, thank you very much for allowing me to be a part of this. Have a wonderful meeting. Take care.
Okay. Thanks, Gary. Appreciate it. I think the topic is definitely germane to what we're going to be talking about today and the disruption. So thank you again and welcome. So with that, let's just quickly talk a little bit about our organization. As I mentioned, we're an outreach organization. We're based locally. Santa Clarita chapter is actually the most recent chapter that we started late last year, but we are a 10-year-old organization, over 2,400 members. We leverage the 8 chapters. We have a bunch here locally. So sometimes we share with Orange County and the LA chapter, with businesses that are close to them as well. And we conduct monthly sessions. We have traditionally done this in person, as you can see a few pictures there. The bottom middle is where we meet in Santa Clarita, traditionally at the College of Canyons. and we hope we can get back to that sometime next year. I also want to have a special thanks to our committee in the blue box there, as you can see to the right. These are folks that are contributing their time, and some of them are panel members today. So I want to thank them for their contributions. This is all a volunteer effort. So the topics that we talk about are coming in through those folks. And I'd like to open up also to the chapter attendees today about future topics. We're always looking for items that are relevant to you and your business. We've talked a lot about disruption this year, but we're certainly interested to hear about maybe some topics that you'd like to hear in the future. So please reach out to any of us. You'll get our contact information at the end of this chapter session, but also know that we have a steering committee also looking at those actively as well. Okay, so let's get into it. I'm excited. This is our first session. I think when Holly and I brainstormed about a future opportunity, we've traditionally done panels in person. So we thought, well, let's give it a go here in Zoom. So I want to welcome Holly. She's the CEO of the Santa Clarita Valley Economic Development Corporation. So hello, Holly.
Good morning.
And good morning. And we have a great panel that I'll get through and we'll talk about. But essentially what we'd like to talk about today is kind of four main areas relevant to facing COVID and the disruption to our business. So we'll talk a little bit about safety protocols and the impact that that has in terms of testing, in terms of PPE that we have to use, the impact to the commercial downturn. As many of us know, Boeing was in a downturn position, self-inflicted with 7 MAX. That had tremendous impact to many of us on the commercial side. We then layer in the situation with COVID and essentially the stop of a lot of capital money flowing through airlines to the OEMs, back to the suppliers, and the impact that that has to us. So that's tremendous. Business continuity is an area that we're also going to talk about. A lot of us have to do business continuity. It's usually a requirement by the aircraft airplane primes or DoD work. We've traditionally looked at that through natural disasters and things. Now we have COVID. That's part of it. So that's influencing some of our continuity plans. So we'll talk about that. And then last but not least is workforce flexibility. We recognize that with some of the restrictions we have and the social distancing, and and the least of which is also the fact that a lot of kids aren't going back to school, we have to be flexible as employers to our valued workforce. So we'll talk a little bit about that as well. And with that, let me introduce our panel. And before I do, I just want to mention we're looking for a Q&A. So we're going to talk about four main topics. We'll have a chart that anchors that topic, but we'd also like for you to raise questions. So we'd love for you to do that through the chat function. Just type in a question or two, and then myself or Holly or Jim Savitz, who's working in the background, will try and raise that question at an appropriate time. So with that, I'd like to introduce our panel. We're excited to have these three fine gentlemen, leaders in their industry. First is Brian Williams, CEO of Avantis Aerospace. So, good morning, Brian. Can you hear me okay?
I can.
Okay. Well, welcome. So Brian of Avantis Aerospace, they're a family of seven A and B businesses, and they also have an industrial supply chain and logistics solutions business. They have a major operation in Valencia. Many of you know that company called Lamsco. And little factoid here, right, Brian, is that you're the largest single manufacturer of shims and laminated shim stock in the world. And that's being done right in the Santa Clarita Valley. So
great.
So welcome to Brian. We're excited to have you here.
Thank you.
Next up is Michael Alfred, president of Crissair Incorporated. Michael, can you hear me okay?
Good morning. Yeah, everything's
fine. Good morning, Michael, and welcome.
Thank you.
Crissair, also based in the Santa Clarita Valley, they manufacture several different types of components in hydraulic and fuel, but fluid control components for both the aerospace and defense industry. And they do end-to-end, right? Michael, you've got embedded engineers, you have test labs, you do development, you do qualification testing.
Correct.
I know you work
yes.
with a lot of tier runs and also the aircraft OEMs.
Exactly.
So
I think the primary thing with Crissair is we have content on just about every aircraft, be it military, fixed wing, or rotary, that's flown, flying now, and probably into the future. So we have a very diverse product line, probably over 14,000 designs.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, it shows how interconnected we are through the supply chain and the ripple effect of when disruption happens. So I know you're going to have some great perspectives on some of the topics. So welcome. And then last but not least, Eric Jensen, Vice President Operations at Freilock Incorporated. So, Eric, welcome. How you doing? Can you hear me okay?
I can hear you fine, Robert. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. And thanks for joining in. So Freilock, for many of you that don't know, also based in Santa Cruz Valley. They also do end-to-end design engineering, also manufacturing of specialty components, sub-assemblies for OEMs in a variety of markets. You know, aerospace is one, and I know you have the luxury of looking at other markets that you participate in, and I know you're doing a lot of satellite business. So a lot of high-tech stuff happening right here in the Valley. So welcome, Eric, and we'll be curious to hear your perspectives also about maybe how you're looking at some of these other industries as well. But
thank you.
So welcome. So the way this is going to work is, you know, Holly and I are going to have an engaging conversation with our panel, and we invite you to raise questions along the way. I think with our allocation here, we've got about 10 minutes per topic, and certainly we can spend a little bit more or less depending on how the flow of this goes. So with that, let me advance the charts here. And we'll start off with our first topic, which is really about safety protocols. And with that, Holly, I'll turn it over to you.
Great. Thanks, Rob. And I want to thank our panelists for being here today. Great companies here in the Santa Cruz Valley. So COVID is obviously the key topic that everybody's been dealing with for the past 6-plus months, really trying to figure out how to navigate that. And so maybe starting with employee safety, all of you, I believe, were essential businesses, so you stayed open. What has been that learning process, and how have you adapted your workplace and your practices to start responding to what seems to be a new way of operating for potentially a quite a long time? So, Brian, I'll start with you, and then we'll talk to others.
Okay, thank you. I think just like a lot of businesses, there's maybe two or three aspects of what we've done to keep employees safe. We have a lot of military business, and so we were an essential business from the early days and have been kept operating all this time throughout the pandemic. Hygiene, of course, is a big deal. So in the early days, we all know the sanitizers, the hand washing, and all the protocols around that. We also did a lot to fumigate plants that we don't do much more of. But there were a lot of surface treatments and fumigations that we would do after hours to keep the plants clean. Secondly, there was a lot of effort and is still on distancing and protections. And so we've handled that in a couple of different ways. In the case of hourly workers with machines, and we do a lot of machining, we've actually moved the machines out further. We've staggered shifts, so we've got a better balance now of people on both second and third shift than we ever used to in the past, right? And the purpose of that is to keep the machinists further apart from each other. So where we couldn't move machines, we've moved people to other shifts in a way to have social distancing for people that could not work from home. Then the rest of it, we initially sent people out to work from home. Since then, I think we've evolved to a hybrid. I would say that for our engineering staff, most of them are in the plant, I would say 3 days a week, maybe only 2 days working from home. For administrative people, they might be in the plant only 1 day a week, maybe two, and the rest of the time from home. So there has been a hybrid approach that we found to be efficient and to work a little bit better. We've also done a lot in the office areas with shields and special protocols and spacings as well that have given us confidence that we can do more working together as teams live in the plant and still keep people safe. So I think that what we have now is a better solution than what we started off with in April. There's been more of a hybrid approach for office workers and engineers. Engineers particularly, we started losing traction having too many engineers working from home. We lost a lot of the team-based culture that we needed, the tight communication, iterations that are required for designs. I'd be interested to see what Mike and Eric say about that, right? So we had to kind of, you know, recall some of those engineers back, get people working together a little bit more tightly, if not still having them far apart. Lastly, we did have a testing program, and still do, actually. We've been doing uniquely, I think, monthly testing of all employees since April. And this is over three sites, our site in Santa Clarita, in San Diego, also in North Hollywood. We started off in April. We got about a 2% hit rate of positives. And within those positives, I would say about 10-15% would be false positives. So we had a little protocol for ferreting out which were false positives. And then we do contact tracing and quarantining like all the rest of us. What's happened because of that is since July, we haven't had any positives at all. So now we're kind of saying, gee, maybe we can stop doing the testing because we're not really finding anything. But then we're a bit of a conundrum. Maybe the testing is helping keeping us at zero positives, right? We've kind of surgically done the testing now with certain groups that might be more at risk rather than making it universal. But it's been an interesting experiment. We hired nurses to do the swab tests, and we used a West LA lab to do the processing. And because we're kind of a VIP customer, we've been getting a 24-hour turnaround on the results. So it's been a good experience. Has kept us safe. More recently, we've had the insurance covering it, which has been great. Wasn't always the case. And so that's been the other thing. But I think that's winding down. Go ahead, Holly.
I was going to say, just to clarify a couple questions coming in, and I'm going to go on to Eric, is your false positive is because you retest, correct? You have a protocol around that.
Yeah, as soon as someone gets a positive and they don't have symptoms, then we do two quick additional tests in successive days. So essentially we will have test, off day, test, test. And if we get three positives in a row, then we know we've got someone who's just asymptomatic. And I would say of all our real positives, about one out of four people don't have symptoms.
Eric, I'm going to go over to you. I mean, Brian talked a lot about shift, you know, how they're adjusting shifts and obviously the hygiene and sanitation protocols. What else did you do at Fralock that, and what was sort of your iterative learning process like?
So thank you, Holly and Brian. So I'll mirror a lot of what Brian says. I think for us, it's a combination of all these different steps to protect the employees. One of the challenges we've had is just keeping up with the constant changing of the regulations, making sure we're compliant. And we're not doing any testing, but with the things that we have done, all the cases we've had have been caught outside of Fralock. Nobody's been infected from somebody while they were at Fralock. Some other things that we've done that Brian hadn't touched upon. For example, we've made all the toilets and all the faucets electronic. We put tape over the latches on the doors so you don't have to, you can push the door one way, you don't have to hold the handle. You know, the other types of things Brian's talked about we've done. We also have an infectious disease and control plan that lays out our protocol for whatever happens. This is the protocol for how you act within the facility. We are asking people to wear masks on company property so that there's no chance they can get infected. And then once we have an event, what's the protocol? We had Zoom all hands meetings with folks to talk about what's going on, to share information. We have a rolling, you know, Zoom cart. So I roll it out to the shop, and we have meetings out of the shop that are led by our CEO. We have turned the blowers for the air conditioners on 24. We're working 7 days a week now. While people are here, the blowers on the air conditioners are running all the time to get a better air exchange. And we changed out our filters to go to a MERV 13 filter, which will take out some of the COVID.
Yeah, great. Love to continue talking about the HVAC and other technology solutions there. But Mike, why don't you layer in pieces that that you're doing there at Crissair that maybe Brian and Eric didn't hit?
Well, we've done, like I said, just about everything they're talking about. Two things we do for outside visitors. We've got a protocol in place where we ask the people that want to come into the facility, you know, where they've been for the last 14 days. Necessarily that if they've been in hot spots or not, we need to know that before they come in. Obviously, if they've been in hot spots, we don't allow them in the facility. And the other thing we do is we bought some of those chlorine mist sprayers, and we do that frequently during the week. Doorknobs, rails, heavily touched places, both in the shop and in the office. And we've been very fortunate. I mean, we've been open from day one. We did send people home at a point in time, but they all came back after the fourth. And it's worked out well. We've only had one incident. It was a very minor incident. People associated him were all sent out for testing. They all come back negative. So we've been very fortunate. I think a lot has to do is we've kind of locked ourselves down and not allowed people we don't know to come into the facility unless we thoroughly vet them through that where have you been for 14-day questionnaire. And like everybody else, we have a you know mitigation protocol in place that if something does happen, we just walk right down through it. And we've been very good at handling that for the one incident we had. So it's worked out well for us. And hopefully at some point in time, this will all go away because it's a big burden. You know, it's been expensive to do a lot of the PPE stuff. I mean, and to Eric's point, we require a mask in the office. If you're in your own office, that's okay. But when you're out walking around on the shop floor through the office, masks are required. And the social distancing, we had to split the lunch hours up. Some people go at 10:30, yeah. People go after 11 o'clock. And, you know, we have a big enough facility here where a lot of people can go outdoors. You know, got the tables and everything outdoors, so they can do that routine too. So,
have you, Mike, and or others? Have you? You talked about sort of being locked down from visitors that you're not screening. Do you restrict access to certain parts of the plant and say only certain people can go in there just to try to change interactions, or does that hamper operations too much?
No, we don't have that in place. I mean, it's pretty open downstairs. I mean, we have a large facility, very high ceilings. The air conditioning, the airflow is good, and we've made sure the airflow is good in some of the more confined places. We've spread people out. Brian mentioned about the second shift and that we've put a lot of people back on second shift to spread out the day shift a little bit more. So just spreading people out a lot, and I think if you've been in our building, it's large, it's very open, and as long as the air conditioning is running, filters get changed frequently.
That
resolves a lot of those airborne type of issues that you get into.
Yeah, filtration and obviously the high ceilings seem to be a big advantage in our industrial facilities.
Well, Holly, I'll just add, yeah, we're locked, so you can't get in without their pre-approval forms, et cetera. We're still doing temperature checks, which you know are less and less valid, it would appear. But once you're in the facility, people go where they need to go to get their job done. It has been a productivity impact overall, not to mention the cost. But we still have many people that are out working remotely: program managers, some of the engineers, contracts people. I mean, there's people I haven't seen in months, except on Zoom.
Yeah. So thank you, guys. I'm going to turn it back to Rob to talk about sort of the other layer of disruption beyond COVID that you guys are dealing with. So, Rob, I'll take it back to you.
Yeah, thank you. And I know Kathleen on chat just brought up a question.
So the county has a new certificate program. It's pretty new. I'm going to guess that you guys haven't spent a lot of time looking at it, but are any of you guys either using independent certificate programs to show that you're complying with COVID-19 protocols or looking at, is that something that's important to you or your employees to see that you're following those protocols? Is that anything any of you guys are looking at?
No.
Okay. Oh, the program's very new. It's only been out a week or two. Happy to get more info to you or anybody on the call that wants to know more about that. But it is brand new.
Yeah, well, you know, we did see that certificate program, but since we've been operating from day one and we've only had the one minor incident, we consider ourselves compliant by default.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, another paperwork type of an exercise is probably not something we're going to pursue immediately.
Yeah.
So.
Great. Thanks. All right, Rob, back to you.
Well, thank you. Great job. And, you know, I think when it comes to the regulation part of this, you know this is going to be the front end of more, and we have to deal with OSHA and ISO and AS9100. So we'll see where all this goes down the line, but some great insights. So thank you. Okay, so let's talk about topic number two, and this has been a big one, as many of you know, especially with the MACs and the recertification that's still ongoing. We're still waiting for more news, but there's been a lot of impact disruption to the commercial. And, you know, I know that our industry is cyclic. Military goes down, commercial goes up. It's usually an inverse relationship, and we're seeing a lot more military and defense work. But with commercial significantly down, this one looks to be a little more significant than previous downturns. And, you know, the spool up or the recovery looks to be multiple years out. Some are saying international travel may not return to normality as we knew it for another 4 or 5 years. So tremendous impact to our panel and the companies that they represent. And so what I'd like to do is open up first with you, Michael, and just talk a little bit about how this disruption has impacted your thinking and your approach, and maybe what are you doing differently in your strategy now that COVID is kind of really fully gravitated to the impact to our industry.
Right. It's kind of, you know, there's a couple of black swan events. Obviously, the MAX was a black swan event. The COVID is even a bigger black swan event for us. About 65% of our business is commercial aerospace, and like I mentioned earlier, we're just about on every platform, if not every platform that flies commercially. So it's had a big impact on us. But a couple of metrics I want to go through first. One of the leading-edge metrics out there is the revenue passenger kilometers, which gives you an idea of how many commercial passengers fly in the domestic U.S. Pre-COVID, it was about 2.5 million passengers a day. When COVID hit back in April, I think it was 14th, that number went down below 90,000 a day, or almost a 96% reduction in the amount of air travel domestically. It's climbed back up to about 750,000 on average, the last 7-day moving average we track. So it's still down over 60% in travel. That caused the airlines to, you know, park about 40% of their fleets out in the desert or wherever. So they're running at 60% capacity. Obviously, you can walk down through that logic trail and figure out that, well, at 60% capacity, I don't need to order a whole lot of new planes. I don't need to take the planes I've got on order. So that ripples down to the supply chain. And, you know, the supply chain then gets into the, the situation where we were producing at X, now we're producing at X minus, you know, 40%. So that whole contraction is rippled through. I don't think we've seen the bottom in the supply chain for the amount of inventory that's out there. And I can give you a brief example of that. On the single aisle aircraft, they were building, let's just say, between Airbus and Boeing, about 105 aircraft a month. Now, there's about 400,000 parts on a single aisle aircraft. So that's 800,000 components on the two aircraft times 105, or about 84 million components a month in that supply chain just to support those platforms. On an annual basis, that's over 1 billion components just for the single aisle aircraft. Now, you were producing at that level, and all of a sudden, 40% of that goes away. And the other black swan event with the MAX kind of went to zero. So it had a big 60% contraction in that single aisle space, but you were producing at 1 billion. So there's a lot of inventory out there. Until that inventory, you know, normalizes, it's going to be hard to put together any type of an internal production plan for ourselves to figure out what that run rate internally to us means. the experts, Canaccord Genuity, put out a survey, and it came back that 70% of the respondents in that survey are looking at second half of 21 for all that inventory out there to normalize. That's the long time from now. Is it 70%? Is it second half? Is that May? Is that June, April? I don't think anyone really knows. But until that inventory normalizes and that air traffic comes back to my first point, back to the 2.5 million travelers a day domestically, it's hard to say when things get back to normal. But what we're looking at, it's not going to all happen at once. It's not going to be like a down to the bottom and then back up to the top the next day in some type of a V-shaped recovery. It's going to take a while for that inventory to sort through. Things will function normally, and we'll start to see some uptick probably in the first quarter of next year. Certainly not back to pre-COVID levels, and certainly not to back to... And part of that Canaccord Genuity survey was there's a lot of people out there in that survey. About 30% said the MAX is never going to return to even 32 aircraft a month when it does come back on production. So there's a lot of, you know, speculation out there what will happen, what can happen. And to that point of the air traffic, the revenue passenger kilometers, Wells Fargo came out with a report the other day that said they're looking at 2024 for that domestic travel to get back to the 2.5 million a day. Mm-hmm. So you've got all kinds of speculation going on out there. It's hard to deal with. What we've done at Crissair, though, on a micro level, is we're just dealing with what we have. We've made the adjustments we think will get us through this storm and have those, you know, that black swan turn into a white swan down the road somewhere. And hopefully, you know, we'll get to that point. But it's the next year or so, it's going to be a difficult, especially on the commercial aerospace side. The good part to us is we have a good 25 to 30% of our businesses in the defense. That seems to be going very, that seems to be going very well. And if you look at the reports, the 250 appropriated for the next couple of years for defense spending is hitting that mark. So that is going strong. That will help us get through. And whatever little commercial business, when it does come back, we'll be ready to do that. So,
yeah, and good feedback. Thank you, Michael. It's amazing the impact to the supply chain. And you're relying on your suppliers to provide those raw materials as well. So, you know, Brian, you know, I know that's an area that you have to focus on as well. Maybe you can talk a little bit about the downturn and how you're managing some of that capital.
Yeah, no, I think, and let me start with something, too. I really agree with Mike's assessment. Boeing's problems go beyond the 737 MAX. And so you have the pandemic. But then on the overlay on top of this, you have Boeing's mis-executions. And they haven't really done the supply base any favors, just to be – I'm an old Boeing employee, so I get kind of ornery about it. Right? But they've had restart difficulties, particularly after their April shutdowns. They've had organizational upheaval, a lot of changeouts of people and management and layoffs. And they've also had a lot of unexpected technical challenges on 787 that have really slowed things down. And so when I look at what Boeing's rate announcements have been, what they have promised the world, how many airplanes that they would really build, be it MAX or 787 or 777 or 767, their actual execution since April has only been one-third of that. There's this massive gap between what Boeing is saying they want to do and what they actually do. And these execution problems are creating a lot of uncertainty that Mike referred to in the supply base. And what I'm concluding from that is, regardless of the pandemic, Boeing is still living in the demand shock world. They're still on the floor. They are not at the new normal yet. Airbus is probably approaching the new normal. They're actually building planes pretty much in line with their announcements. And so what you see a lot of supply-based folks doing like us is we are pivoting a lot to military business and to Airbus business to reduce dependency on the Boeing commercial work. Meanwhile, the military or defense side of Boeing is executing very well. So that's another attractive area for us. But we can all hope that Boeing gets stable and actually build some commercial airplanes, right, sometime before I die.
that would help a lot.
Oh my gosh! So it's been a lot of volatility, and so there's two problems that have been affecting us. One is the big disconnect between what the OEMs tell us is going to happen and what really happens, which didn't used to occur in 2019 when changes were much more slight, right? So it makes it hard to plan our lives. And then there is the actual impact of the pandemic, which, as Mike well said, is driven by passenger traffic and the replacement market and macroeconomic conditions. And so I'm hoping that sometime between now and, say, the first quarter of next year, that these OEMs establish the new normal and get out of the demand shock mode. But yeah, we're really struggling as an industry, and we are given this ratcheting, volatile, unpredictable demand stream and minuscule demand stream from our customers. And then we have little shops supporting us. We try to master schedule and smooth demand and keep them as stable as we can. But I there's no nice way to say it. Boeing has let down the industry. They have not done the commercial aircraft industry any favors. And again, if I look at our revenue problems and the drops that we have, I would say one-third of our problem is from the pandemic itself, and two-thirds of our problem right now have been from Boeing's mis-executions. So it's an important overlay, and I think we're all living it. You all know what I'm saying, and it's the reality.
Yeah,
Rob?
Yeah.
So one of the things that I think you talk about or people need to be aware of certainly is there's a lot of small shops. Ronnie just mentioned it. They're not going to be around. There's organizations going bankrupt. They're not going to survive. That's going to further damage the supply chain. Opportunities for some, but it's not as if we're going to just ramp back up again, because there's going to be people that are no longer available to do some of our work.
Yeah, that's
continued damage that we haven't even seen yet.
That's the one thing about the aircraft business is you just can't light switch an aircraft factory. You can light switch it off, but you can't light switch it back on.
Exactly right, Mike. Yeah.
And, you know, to Eric's point, you know, there is an opportunity, the silver lining out there, that some of these smaller guys aren't going to make it. So there's an opportunity to step in and do some M&A work there. And that may hold over, but until Boeing and Airbus and the like get to a minimum sustainable production level that will support the supply chain, it's still going to be, you know, a hit and a miss type of a month over month, quarter over quarter type of year going forward.
Yeah, indeed. Go ahead, Brian.
Maybe just quickly to Mike's point, we are trying to be active in the M&A world. We are going to close on two deals tomorrow that you'll see a press release on, where we're buying two military fastener companies, right? And there's opportunism in buying these, as Mike, you alluded to. And it's not accidental that they have military content, right? So we're trying to counterbalance our dependency on the Boeing commercial problems that we've been seeing by, again, rotating to the military business or rotating to Airbus business.
Well, tremendous impact, and I appreciate the feedback. We could probably have a dedicated chapter session on the disruption piece of our equation. And now you're reading, you know, Boeing maybe consolidating 787 line to Charleston, South Carolina. So we're going to see more disruption, and it creates some opportunities. So congratulations, Brian. It's nice to see that there are some opportunity out there. But we'll probably have a topic on how we hit the switch on. Because to your point, Michael, it's easy to turn it off. But, and that's the thing, is that we're all interconnected with all the capital. So to turn it back on and to get to the rates that are maybe needed with the recovery, hopefully, that will also be a challenge. So,
you know, as crazy as it sounds from those Boeing shutdowns, they are still struggling since May to find normalcy. That's how long it has taken to recover from those shutdowns.
Indeed. Well, let's talk about our next topic. We will probably do a little less time on these last two, but that's okay. This was meant to be organic, and we still want you to raise your questions as you go through. The next one is really about business continuity, it's one of those nefarious things that I think we have to put in a policy and put on the shelf. But now more than ever, certainly with COVID, what are we doing to adapt our business strategies, our IP, our things that are sensitive to us to keep the operation going? As many of you know, we're in the Santa Clarita Valley area, and we're still in fire season. So, while that may have been reduced a notch or two, we've certainly had some close calls even this year. So with that, you know, Eric, I'll start with you. You know, just maybe just talk about how you've maybe adapted your continuity plan slightly now that you have COVID and, you know, maybe there's an outbreak or what have you. But maybe if you could start us off with maybe things that you're considering now that you weren't considering 6-7 months ago.
Okay, thank you. So this is going to sound a little odd, but one of the things we're looking at is essentially having a safety stock level of employees. So the reality is you could lose a key resource, you could lose a department, you could have to shut the entire plant. Our facility normally operates 5 by 24. We've got a couple of operations that run into the third shift. And we are, because we're spread around and we have a fair amount of semiconductor business, we've been very busy and operating Saturdays 12 hours, Sundays an 8-hour shift in particular areas. Early on, we lost at one point roughly 30% of our direct employees for a variety of reasons. Daycare, they were out ill, didn't want to come in, et cetera, et cetera. So we're managing with, if you look on our website, we're trying to hire people, and we have temps in at the same time. We brought another temp organization in. We've improved our training programs so that, and I'm trying to work the organization back down to the 5-day-a-week with limited overtime, so if something goes wrong, we can sprint. So for us, it's about having available sprint capacity to cover an event. And we also have our disease prevention and control plan where we, within an hour, we've done a level of, we've cleared the area, we've cleaned the area, we've isolated people, we've done contact tracing, so we can limit the damage. And it's become cultural now for this to be done. We regularly communicate what's going on, and this is going to sound a little odd too, but we're almost in a routine now relative to COVID, masks, physical distancing, et cetera. It's become more normal, so we've had to change the culture. And we do have a BCP, but now it needs updating, because where are you going to go? Okay, we'll have alternate production in. Where's COVID not? COVID's everywhere. So you've got to have your own internal sprint capacity, partnerships with some of your suppliers. We acquired a company earlier in the year in Chatsworth. We're working with them. We're looking at other acquisition. So it's about having sprint capacity and safety stock. And we also have a backup plan. If I'm out because I get COVID, who's going to take my spot? So we're working on that also. This last I want to add that while we're doing Zoom meetings, we're doing Microsoft Teams, we're doing phone calls, it's still, in my opinion, not as productive as some of the face-to-face discussions. So we do put people in rooms spread apart, but there's a level of interaction that is still missing even with a Zoom call. So we are still having some sessions, but feeling the effects of folks that are isolated, like program managers. They're not here for a month or two or three. They don't really have a sense of what's going on in the organization. There's something about walking through and seeing and talking to people that is missing. So they're somewhat isolated with some level of assumptions about what's going on instead of go seeing. You can't do a gemba walk on a Zoom call.
Correct.
It's true. There are limitations to our technology here. But I think what was striking of what you said is the safety stock of employees. That's a term I haven't heard of before. We're always talking about our capital and our things. But I think that's a good gateway maybe into the next topic that I'll turn over to Holly, and that is really about the workforce flexibility.
Yeah, I'd just like to pick up on what Eric was just saying and ask – you know, what percent of your employees did you have working from home? What percent do you have now? And what percent do you anticipate in, let's say, Q1? And what's that trend that you guys are seeing in the work from home model? Let's start there. Mike, do you want to?
We had about 25 to 30% working at home. Right now, it's minimal. I think it was only one or two. But to Eric's point, is you're right. You can't do a gemba walk in the factory by Zoom. People tend to act differently when they're on a Zoom as when they're person to person, because you don't have that social interaction. The other thing that will probably change over time with, a lot of employees here have families and such. The daycare centers have been closed. Schools are closed. But mom or dad's got to be home to monitor that situation. So they're going to have to be off from work. They're going to have to work from home during that meeting. That will probably be something that sticks. Now, whether it's 100% or 2 days a week or whatever that amounts to, but that work from home is probably going to stick, because you see some of the bigger tech companies saying, we don't want you guys back in the office until sometime next year. People can read that. How come I can't work at home when everybody else is? My boss, he wants people in the office every day. And so that's a constraint we're working with. But I think over time, that whole workforce flexibility is going to become more that people are going to have to balance that work-life relationship. And that's going to force a lot of people to work part-time from home. And it puts a burden on the company, unless, you have the safety stock of employees, unless you have the culture that will support that. So those are things that will probably change. And in my estimation, some of that will be for the better. Happy employees, a productive employee, and I think that will work fine. And it's just a matter of time and how you go about it. There are no protocols for this type of a thing, right? I mean, some companies do it different than everybody else, but I think you're going to get to that point where work is going to be, we work 4-10s now, so anybody can stretch it out and you can work 6 days a week. You might have to work Saturday morning from home. You might have to take Monday off, things like that. So the whole schedule of work, especially if you can do that, you obviously can't do that for the factory. You've got product to make, customers to satisfy, and things like that. But I think that will be one of the things that sticks, that comes out of this whole COVID thing, will be some type of a workforce flexibility, and employers will be forced into that, because if you don't, you're competing with the guy down the street that has that amount of workforce flexibility, so your workforce will go there as opposed to coming to you with a rigid clock in at 6, clock out at 4:30, 5 days a week type of a thing. So,
Brian, what percent, you said you're bringing folks back. Let me go, since we're getting towards the end of time, some really great questions that are coming in. How are you dealing with, and maybe I don't see if anybody wants to answer this, but how are you dealing with wage and hour issues, wage and hour claims? How are you dealing with temporary workers?
Yeah, it's interesting. I knock on wood when I say this, but there has been a workers' comp avenue with COVID, right? And that has not materialized into very much for us. The burden of proof for employees to have to show that they follow proper protocols, and I know there's a lot of lawyers you see on TV that are advertising this, but in practice, we haven't really had any material workers' comp claims related to COVID. We have had a lot of parents, however, with online school. And so we've had to be flexible with shifts, with some work-at-home arrangements, and we really have tried to accommodate employees. So it's maybe more of a time issue, primarily right now related to school, kids being at home, right, for school, and parents want to be supervising them. And we've just been flexible in kind of working through that. I don't think that's a long-term condition. The last thing, that really strikes me as we've all been talking, we don't have that many people working from home except in those situations either. Much like Mike, we used to have a lot more. I think what that means is that the masks work. The social distancing works. The hygiene works. And we can still have teams of people working on-site together at the workplace and not really incur much additional risk. So we found that the other protocols are sufficient to keep people safe, and there is not a safety need to have people work from home. All that we're dealing now is accommodation for things like school and kids and these kinds of problems.
Eric, you've talked about, because you do a lot of, you know, work in other fields than commercial aerospace, your workload has increased. Have you brought temporary employees on? What's onboarding like if you're doing that? How are you dealing with that workload surge in your case?
Well, the temps come through two different agencies. They have to follow all the protocols as anybody we would hire, the background checks. We have, you know, temperature checks on the way in. Everybody's required to validate every day they don't have X amount of symptoms, which continues to grow. So we have a combination of people we're bringing in, temps to fill up our safety stock of employees. We're working a lot. We're trying to get our sprint capacity back. And I also want to mirror what both Brian and Mike have said. We're being flexible. We don't want to lose employees. It's been a little challenging with the hourly employees because, in general, that's much more challenging than a salaried employee from a start time, stop time, lunch time. You know, there's some level of risk there. But, you know, I feel safer here than I do going to the grocery store. So, and that's what I think our employees believe that, and the evidence points out.
Yep.
Yes, you haven't caught anything from here. People catch it from the outside. So all these things we're doing.
So, Rob, we are getting towards
Well, thank you. I think some really good feedback. I love the message, Brian, that, look, under these unprecedented times, you and Michael and Eric are finding ways to win. And I think that's a wonderful message to our community that this you can manage through this. Mask wearing and some of the precautions that you're doing are probably 90% of it, right? And so
right. It's
a wonderful message. And I suspect that once rapid testing is available to us, that we could do it on site and it could be immediate. That would probably be another tremendous asset as this technology evolves and we are able to address it. So thank you. I know we could probably go on for another hour. So, we had five topics. We moved it to four. There were some great questions online.
And Rob, I would encourage folks to, you know, they can email me at the Santa Clara Valley Economic Development Corporation. They can obviously email you. Rob is the chair.
Yeah.
But my email is on our website, so that's easy for people to find. But we're looking for topics, and we want feedback on, the topics for future, how many localized versus national topics, et cetera. So I'll let you expand on that.
I appreciate that. And so a full network list, I think we had almost 40 attendees today, so everyone will get a network list to really connect, because that's really the basis of us getting together. And so we really appreciate the panel for sharing lessons learned and some of the pain that they've gone through. But I think what we're trying to accomplish here, at least locally, is to have some interconnections that you don't have to learn everything on your own the first time. And if there are questions, I think we'd love to hear from you. And we'd love for that to maybe be a future topic as well. So so just quickly on upcoming chapter sessions, we're going to continue our Zoom journey here. I think what we're probably looking at is hopefully Q1, Q2 next year we can get maybe in person, but that's really dependent on where we are as a country and where it's safe. But just know that the other chapter sessions are also holding sessions. So in October, we have a full list of some new chapter sessions. Orange County, we have some national. And then I think Dallas also has one as well. So if you're a member, you can join into any of these. Also know that these chapter sessions are recorded, and you can access the content and the recordings on the aerospacedefenseforum.org. And as a member, you'll have full access to that. So that's a nice reference to go back to at times. And as Holly mentioned, we're also looking for future topics. So we'd love to hear from you, and please reach out to any of us on the call or through your steering committee, and we'll be happy to hopefully host some of those in the future. So with that said, I'd like to thank our panel again, Brian, Eric, and Michael, and Holly. You guys did an outstanding job, so thank you for your time, your feedback. And I wish everybody a safe week, and hopefully we can continue this on here next month. So thank you again, and we're signing out.